Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Let's get started with the concern about the coronavirus. As it spreads, more and more precautions are being taken. You have one college and university after another canceling in-person classes, switching to online classes. Some schools are telling students not to return to campus until after spring break. Last night, Santa Clara County, California, announced a ban on all gatherings of 1,000 people or more for the rest of the month, which could include three San Jose Shark home games. The team issued a statement that they are reviewing their options. Moreover, it was reported that Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy will be taped without audiences. According to John Rothstein, the Ivy League is canceling its postseason conference tournament, and the regular season champion, Yale, goes to the NCAA tournament as the champ. And then you have a number of leagues overseas that are playing games without fans and flat-out postponing games. Despite that fact, North American leagues are not at that point. That said, you can see it from here. This is how serious the virus is. It's not a hoax. It's real. And it's killing people. And while games continue in all of the major professional leagues over the weekend, a number of NHL teams began closing their dressing rooms to media and non-essential personnel. And last night, it became even bigger. Last night, the NBA, NHL, MLB, and MLS issued a joint statement announcing that they would be closing access to locker rooms and clubhouses for all non-essential personnel. That statement read, quote, "Given the issues that can be associated with close contact in pre- and post-game settings, all team locker rooms and clubhouses will be open only to players and essential employees of teams and team facilities until further notice. Media access will be maintained in designated locations outside of the locker room and clubhouse setting." End quote. My reaction to that is this. Given the circumstances, it's not at all surprising. After all, from the standpoint of the league, the most important thing is keeping the players free from the virus. If a player gets it, and then a team gets it, then all hell breaks loose, and then the league is in real trouble. So I understand why the leagues would make an announcement like that. That said, we have to make sure that this does not become the new normal once concerns about the virus die down. Changes like this do have a way of becoming permanent because it's easier for the teams and for the players. But easier is not better. It's not better for the game. Right now, perhaps. Right now, perhaps. But before some of you dopes come in here and take a run at beat writers and say that they're just whining because they don't have access to the locker room, it's not about that. Because media access in the locker room is not just about media members getting good access. It's also about fans getting good access. Because the media plays a huge role in connecting players and teams to the fans. I'm not just saying that because I'm media. That's a fact. Media access in the locker room or a clubhouse is about building the relationships and connections that lead to good stories. And here's the other thing about restricting access on a permanent basis. And again, I want to be very clear about this. I understand why they're restricting access right now. I'm just saying that when it does turn and it does get better, let's make sure it's not permanent. Because if you restrict access on a permanent basis, you're going to miss out on a lot. You do that, and you do not get moments like Pac-Man Jones and Terrell Pryor.
I know you talked about it, Adam. What did that start with for you, and Terrell?
Garbage.
There you go, right there,
huh? Oh,
there you go.
Get him out of there. You see him in there?
Oh, right there.
You better find him somebody to play with.
Is it him saying basically he could
garbage? Garbage.
All right, Adam. Aside from Terrell, how big is it for you?
Garbage. I ain't talking about nothing else. I'm happy we won.
All right, cool.
Terrell Pryor, garbage.
All right.
You tell me, how much worse would life be if we did not have Pac-Man calling Pryor garbage?
Garbage.
And then looking in a trash can to find him.
Garbage.
I could do this all day. Or why don't we throw it all the way back to D'Angelo Hall talking about Falcons coach Mike Smith after a scuffle on the sideline during a Washington-Atlanta game.
Coach Smith, Mike came over, grabbed me, talking to me, saying he'll kick me and all this other so I definitely stand Atlanta in the offseason, so if Mike Smith want to see me, he can find me. Definitely can find me. Definitely can find me. Because that's some yeah, but we'll say that for a different day.
I mean, what an iconic moment. D'Angelo Hall challenging Mike Smith to a fight in the offseason. A star NFL player challenging a coach, a head coach, to a fight. No media in the locker room means we don't get Hall saying that. We don't get Hall saying that he stays in Atlanta in the offseason. So if Mike Smith wants, quote, he can find me. Definitely can find me.
Definitely can find me.
Of course, the team isn't going to want that out there. They don't want to have to deal with what might come from a player challenging an opposing head coach to a fight in the offseason. But that's part of what makes sports great, right? And yes, I know that the players and the coaches will still meet with the media in designated locations outside of the clubhouse or locker room, but you know how those moments at the podium go. They're generally boring. Nothing ever happens. It's rehearsed. It's under control. You know you're not getting the real deal in that environment. The player or coach has had a few minutes to collect their thoughts, maybe even get prepped up by a staffer or a flack. Generally, it's going to be very formal and very boring. Unless we're dealing with somebody like former Michigan women's basketball coach Keith Borseth.
That's how I feel. Damn sick and tired of getting out rebounded. 25 offensive rebounds. First time we block out, we get called for a damn block out. We're pushing people. Meanwhile, they're on the other court grabbing rebounds, going over the top and grabbing them. We get one offensive rebound, the other get called for over the back. We don't block out very damn well, and we're not getting called, one or the other. That's where I'm frustrated. That's where my whole frustration comes in, offensive rebounds. The entire thing came down to offensive rebounds. They got every stinking offensive rebound, and we didn't get one of them. What else do you want to know?
Well, I'm good, Coach. That's how you enter the media room. That's how you start a press conference. Not with some tired, boring, meaningless opening statement and then opening the floor to questions. No, the real pros start a press conference by spiking the stat sheet into the podium before you even see them get on camera. That's a GOAT move. That's an absolute legend.
That's how I feel.
But if you think that every player or coach has it in them to go Borseth in a press conference setting, you're wrong. Again, so I'm very, very clear about this. I'm fine with limiting access to locker rooms in this current environment. But when the concern is lifted, the media better be allowed back into the locker rooms exactly the way they were before. Or I might go all Borseth. Because access is about building relationships, developing contacts, gaining insight, things that might lead to stories down the road. It's also about athletes being open, real, unrehearsed. The concern overall for the virus is very serious. That's why none of you idiots should come in here and try to make light of it and try to make fun of it and try to make jokes about it, because I'm not having any of that. It's not a hoax. It's real, and it's killing people. The side angle to that, and I want to be very clear about that. I'm talking about the media angle above and beyond, or subsequently, and I'm fine with the policy right now, but don't change it permanently. We are joined by Kings head coach Luke Walton. Luke, it's good to have you back. How are you?
Good, Jim. It's been too long, my friend. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing great, Luke. It has been a long time, but it's great to have you back. Let me start right here, Luke. You dropped a tough one to Toronto Sunday night where the lead was going back and forth in the final 4 minutes. When you're battling for a playoff spot, Luke, and you've got a good chance to beat a really good Raptors team, how tough is a loss like that? In other words, can you shake that off pretty quickly, or does that one kind of linger a little longer?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough, Jim, but when you look at it, watch tape and you see how hard our guys are playing and how hard they've been playing, and just the fight in the group, it's very exciting. And we want to win those games. We need to win those games. But Toronto is, like you said, said, that they're a good team. They're the defending champs, and they hit huge shot after huge shot. And what I'm excited about is our guys were right there punch for punch. Plays. De'Aaron Fox goes 10 for 10 from the free throw line. Multiple guys hit, you know, threes. And, you know, it, you know how the NBA works. It's some nights you win those, some nights you don't. Unfortunately, we didn't get that one, but I expect our guys to bounce back and continue rolling come, you know, throughout the rest of this week.
Sacramento Kings head coach Luke Walton is joining us. Since you mentioned De'Aaron Fox, let me ask you about him. I want to get into some of the details of his game, Luke, but overall, what do you make of the season that he's having?
He's playing great right now. He's a big part of why our team is, you know, been having some success over the last 20 games, and the way that he's elevating, the way that he's starting to lead are all the things that we're asking him to do. And we tell him we understand it's a lot to put on his plate, but we fully believe in him being that guy and being able to handle that responsibility. And unfortunately, he got hurt and missed a big portion of the season right in the middle of it. And since he's kind of come back from that and got his legs under him, he's slowly really been just a consistent leader that every good team needs.
Luke Walton is my guest. You mentioned the last 20 games, Luke. You had lost six straight in January, but you've gone 13-7 since that loss at Detroit. After that game, you changed up the starting lineup a bit. What do you make of the way the team overall, not just Fox, but the team overall, has responded to the challenge?
They've been great. You know, we've had ups and downs this year. It's been a you know, an interesting first season, and it's been a lot of good with some bad in there. But what you love to see from your group is, you know, you never give in, you never quit, no matter how bad things get. We have the power to turn things around, and this group continues to fight. And you know, the lineup change mixed with De'Aaron kind of getting his legs back from that injury, Vlade doing a great job and bringing guys like Alex Lynn and Bazemore over and kind of helping with the physicality of how we want to play has really helped steady the group. And what you're looking for in this league with, you know, the schedule we play and how many games, it's just consistency, and that's what we're starting. And you know you're not going to win them all, but as long as you're playing hard and you're playing consistent, you know, good things are going to happen, and that's kind of the groove that we're in right now.
We're talking Sacramento Kings basketball here in the Jungle. Head coach Luke Walton is my guest. You know, Luke, you're in that rugged West, and you're just on the outside looking in, but you've got a really good look at this thing. When you're dealing with a number of players who do not have playoff experience and certainly do not have playoff experience together, how do you go about preparing them for that desperation and that intensity night in and night out?
Well, you keep the priority on what's important, and that's, you know, let's not get overwhelmed and put added pressure on us by just sitting around talking about the playoffs and how every game is, you know, is a must win. Let's just continue to do what we're doing. We're playing really good basketball. We're playing as a team. We're winning games, and let's focus on that and ultimately know that to take the next step as a group, We have to get to the playoffs and feel what that's like. But even this stretch right here, Jim, just a level below that as far as taking a jump, you know, towards the end of the season is where playoff teams really start turning it up. Every team is fighting for positioning or to get into the playoffs. And that type of intensity in itself and being in those games and playing, you know, teams like Toronto down to the stretch, that's great learning opportunities. That's great experience for our group. And we're a new group. You know, we got a new coaching staff. We got new players trying to get everyone on the same page and understand the offense and defensive system. And going through this together is a great opportunity for us.
And, Luke, you've got a guy in Kent Bazemore that I've always liked. I've always liked his game and his approach. He arrived in that trade with Portland. In terms of his approach, what do you like about what he's brought to the team? And how much of a difference has he made?
He's been great. His just overall energy and how he adjusts is in constant attack mode. He plays on the defensive end, you know, without fear. He's willing to guard anybody. And he's one of those players that their energy is contagious. And he's been great. You know, you get him on the floor with Corey Joseph, who's just another winner, and then what Alex Lynn has brought to the physicality of our team has really just settled us in nicely to the defensive end. We've talked all year, and we started the season off being a pretty poor defensive team, and we slowly made the right strides that we're looking for. And Baze is a big, big part of that.
You mentioned Alex Lynn, Luke Walton, my guest. Of course, you got into it a little bit with C.J. McCollum in that win over Portland. It is the second time he's gotten into a scuffle since he arrived. Hey, Luke, I know you're not looking for guys to go out and just get into fights, but in terms of that physicality, how much do you like that edge and that physicality that he does bring to the floor?
I love it. I love it, Jim. And it's you're absolutely right. We don't ever want it to get to a fight. We don't ever want anyone to get hurt, but we do want to stand up for ourselves. We do want other teams to feel us, and a lot of times that responsibility will fall on the bigs, and I think he does a nice job of playing with that edge. We've missed Rashawn Holmes for the last month of games, however long that's been, and he has that edge. Harry Giles has done a nice job of stepping in for us with all the other bigs out and playing with an edge. And, you know, there's always somebody. You look at the Clippers, and Pat Beverly has that for them, and Marcus Smart for the Celtics. So we're looking for guys that have that edge, again, not to fight, but to always be ready to say, hey, we're not going to get pushed around tonight. We're going to be here to put our bodies on you as well.
Luke Walton joining me for a few more moments. We're talking Kings basketball. So I mentioned at the very top, Luke, you've got a big one. You're tied with New Orleans for the ninth spot in the West. They're coming to your house tomorrow night. I also understand that every game at this point in the season is huge, but how big does this one feel?
This is going to be fun. This New Orleans team is playing great. Alvin's doing a heck of a job. They're flying up and down the court. They got all five shooters out there, and they're just, you know, they're spacing the floor. They're coming at you, and you know we haven't played them since Zion's been back. And this, as a staff, we're sitting around watching tape, figuring out what to do and what, you know, do you put a smaller forward on, a power forward on him? Do you put a center on him? And it seems like every team that's trying different things, he's still finding a way to get the job done. So this is going to be a fun game. It's like you said, it's a big game seeding wise, and something that our players should be up and excited for, and the city should be excited for.
I was about to ask, Luke, what do you do, or how do you go about trying to limit or impact his game? You kind of answered that in part, but even though you haven't seen him firsthand, when you look at him on tape, what kind of thoughts do you have?
Just really impressed. I mean, for a rookie to come into the league, especially coming off injury and not have time to kind of find his groove through the start of the season, and then just come out and do what he's doing to teams, is you got to give this young man a ton of credit. He's going to be a star in this league for a lot of years. And, you know, for us, we're going to throw different people on him. We got to, like we said, we haven't played him yet. So we have to see what that's like and see who has success on him. But he'll be a big part of the game plan, trying to slow him down and ultimately slow that whole offense down. It's not just Zion. They got Brandon Ingram, was an all-star. Zoe is playing incredibly well, shooting the heck out of the ball. So this is a really good team coming into Sacramento, and we feel the same way about our group. So it should be a lot of fun to be part of this game tomorrow.
That's
night.
A big one tomorrow night. Luke, really quickly, I got about 60 seconds. Kent Bazemore was saying how there's a complete buy-in. Quote, when asked about you, he said, we're behind him 110%. He's just as fiery as any coach I've ever played with. Sometimes it looks like he wants to get out there, but he's kind of chubby now, so those days are over. Luke, what do you think when you hear that?
Well, it's, you know, I have a good relationship with Baze. I encourage open dialogue with my coaching staff and my players. I wasn't a big fan of that line, but I love the buy-in we have from our guys. I love the support we have from our guys, and I love the culture we have going on here. It's a fun place when you're trying to want a place where guys love coming into work every day. and we have that going on here in Zach, and we're just looking to continue to grow, and we're happy that Baze is part of that.
And the biggest thing, Luke, you got to be a fan of this. He did say, he started that off by saying, we're behind him 110%. Any coach wants that buy-in. Luke, it had been a minute. It's great to have you back on the show. Appreciate your time. I know that's an enormous game tomorrow night. Thanks for coming on to talk about that game and the team.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. It's great to be on. I hope you're well, my friend.
You too, Luke. Great talking to you. Thank you so much. He is Steve Elkington. Elk, mate, it's great to have you back. I have to ask you right now, where are you exactly and who are you with?
G'day, Jimmy. Mate, I'm on the fairway, number 5, Players' Championship with PP and Jason Kokrak. Boys are getting some work in.
PP, nice Elk, day. Of course. Windy. Elk. PP is Pat Perez, for those who do not know, but I'm sure everybody does. You tell PP I said, what's up?
He was going to talk, mate, but he's got a mouthful of this Mississippi coleslaw. I don't think he can say anything. He's just spitting everything all over the place. Got to walk way to the side of him.
Mississippi coleslaw. Elk is already out and running. All right, Elk, so the Players is this week, and you are there already. What kind of memories, Elk, come back to you when you head up to and end up at Sawgrass?
Well, you know, it was a big thing for me in 91, Jim, when I won. I was a young guy on the tour. You know, back then this tournament was offering up 10-year exemptions, so I was just a new guy. So, you know, it was a huge game changer.
Elk, what is the locker room for past champions like, and what's it like then to see your name up there?
Small, mate. It's very small. It's a secluded area, which it should be. You know, I think, you know, as you know, in horse racing, Jim, there's places that should be celebrated when you win, right? There's special little places that should be made for special places. Augusta has it up top, and they have it here to a certain degree.
Talking to Steve Elkington. I'm going to talk to you about Augusta in a minute. Elk, what about the course setup overall? How do you see it setting up this week due to the weather?
Well, this tournament, Jim, was always played in March. And March in Florida is a lot windier, a lot different conditions, which it is currently right now. When they went to May, it was very soft. The scoring was very low. So, as you know, the boys are pretty beat up, mate. They were at the Honda Classic, I think, what, 6-under won it. Last week at Bay Hill, I think 5-under won it. The boys are pretty wounded at the moment. And this week, I think, will be not much different. It's a little softer. PB's just made a nice-looking action at about a 5-iron into the fifth hole.
Hmm.
2 or 3 spits, front edge, 50 feet.
Two or three spits.
Out some juice, and off we go.
Off we go. Steve Elkington is joining us. He's on the course with PP. I'm going to get to the fellas and the fact that some of them are beat up, Elk, but the 17th hole, the Island Green, is iconic. What's it like dealing with that hole on Saturday and Sunday when you're in contention?
Mate, it's a weak ruiner. You know, it's almost not fair a hole because there's so much extra stress that goes with it, you know, on a Thursday and Friday because, look, you don't have to miss hit a wedge or 9-iron very much to toe it or catch it a little thin and put one in the drink, and now you're making double and now you're spending the rest of the week trying to get back into the cut. So, yes, it's very stressful. Now, as the weekend comes around, you're a little sort of numb to it. You know, for me, when I won in 91, it was almost impossible. I when I was walking around to the tee, Jim, when I was a young kid, my knees buckled. I was so nervous, and I caught myself. I thought I was going to go down, but I managed to somehow pull that off, birdie on 18. But similarly, in 97, when I actually won the tournament by 7, I was in much, much better shape. I was feeling a lot better, and it was a bit of a breeze. But nonetheless, it's a weak ruiner.
It is a weak ruiner. Steve Elkington joining us. Elk, in terms of the guys who are kind of dinged, Tiger is not there this week. Given his health, it's not a big surprise. How concerning is it to you for the rest of his entire year, though?
Mate, I was thinking about this question today, and the way that I've got this cataloged is we don't really know what's wrong with him. I mean, it could be his pinky finger. We never get the truth out of the Woods camp, which is fine. I don't care. But what it's told me, Jim, is that he is putting all of his eggs into the four majors basket this year. I mean, he's going after 18. So to me, by this move and what he's been doing, he's not doing anything to jeopardize any chances. He can win at Augusta. He doesn't have to be 100% there. As we saw, he shredded them last year mentally. or psychologically he did it. He didn't have to do anything physical that he's done in the past. So I say that he is all eggs in on Golden's 18.
We're talking to Steve Elkington. Elk, speaking of guys in their health, let me jump ahead to Phil Mickelson. He missed the cut at Bay Hill. He missed the cut at the Genesis. He finished third at Pebble. He missed cuts at the Farmers and the American Express. How do Phil and his game look to you right now?
Mate, you have to get out in the woods to find him. That's what they say. But
right.
You know, he's I heard TP's interview. You know, he looks a lot better. There's no doubt about it, and good for him. But it certainly hasn't come across on his game. We've seen guys like Craig Stadler, who was a pretty hefty guy, mate, and then he lost a bunch of weight and he couldn't play. And then he said he didn't have any gut sling anymore. I mean, maybe that's Hefty's deal. He doesn't have the right gut sling anymore.
Yeah, I mean, listen, he looks great, and credits to whatever he's done and the work he's put in. But, Elk, was his game better when he was hefty instead of, like, the male supermodel that he is now?
Mate, when I saw him hit those six chocolate eclairs in 2 minutes at Oak Hill, mate, he was unbeatable. So I'd have to go with B.
Steve Elkington joining us, Elk. All right, what about Brooks Koepka? He shot 81 on Saturday at Bay Hill. He followed that with a 71 on Sunday. And when asked to compare the two rounds, his response was, quote, still bleep, putting better. When told that he probably couldn't swear on the podium, his response was, well, fine me. What's your reaction when you hear that from Brooks?
I love Brooks.
I do, too.
I love him too, man. I think that he's one of the throwbacks of all time. In fact, I think last week he Instagrammed a Brinks truck. I mean, you know how much balls it takes to Instagram out a Brinks truck when he was coming to Bay Hill when he's been playing garbage like he has? I don't know this, but I did visit with Brooks. I went and played his charity event a couple months back. I don't think he's 100%. And I think he's a little bit of a mystery right now. That my daughter had a patella surgery on her left knee, so I know what that's all about. And he has a patella strain, and I don't know if he can – I don't know. I think it's throwing him off.
No, I don't think there's any doubt, Elk. I mean, I don't know. I don't know, but I do know that he's recovering from that partially torn patella tendon last year. I'm assuming that he's not 100%. I would agree without knowing for sure. Now, you and Jason Duffner had a pretty interesting conversation about his approach on the range and how different that is from when he's actually playing. What is the biggest difference from the range to the actual round in terms of what you're thinking about?
Well, you know, for those that think Duff, you know, doesn't say much, Duff, you can't shut Duff up when you're talking with him if you know him. He's a highly intelligent guy, and he's very analytical. And, you know, he understands, you know, he looks at the data and says, look, I missed the ball right. You know, I've got to do better. This is the things I've got to work on. He's a very much, like I say, looks like he's sort of, you know, doesn't think about much, but it's all in. Now, this course is a perfect course for Duffner. He finished third last year. Now, he has had some problem with his putting. I mean, he's carrying around a live snake for a putter sometimes, happens to him. But this is a tournament that he can do well in right here.
Steve Elkington, my guest for a few more moments. Now, Elk, Golf Digest did a survey of PGA Tour pros. One of the questions was essentially, if you were in a bar fight and you could choose one fighter to be with you, who would you choose? Ernie Els was the runaway winner. Elk, who would you choose?
No, I'd take Kokrak. Kokrak's out here with me right now. He's 6'5", 230, and he's angry all the time. So, yeah, no, he'd flip Ernie.
What about Ernie? I mean, Ernie comes off as one of the nicest, classiest guys. Does he have a switch? Why? I mean, he's put together now, but why is everybody quick to pick Ernie?
Well, I tell you what, I can't discredit Ernie, mate. I think he would go all right. I think he'd throw it with you, but I don't know if I'd – I mean, if I'm – you're asking me to go, right? I'm going with Crack. Crack's right. My guy.
I got you. I'm just kind of asking you, how do you think Ells would do if it came to giving somebody the hands?
And then I might go with Fat Eric, the caddy out here. Fat Eric could hold him down at 400. He'd hold him down.
I didn't say who should sit on him. I said how would Ernie do if he had to give somebody the hands. All right.
Oh, yeah. So, no, Eric, Ernie could go.
So how is the SG Tour Golf app going, and what do you have planned for this week, Elk?
Mate, we're good. You know, it's, you know, SG Tour has opened a new game this week. We actually, Hawk and I have been talking. We're putting up a new money game's come out today called Money Grabber. mate, I like simple golf games because fantasy golf sucks. You got to have salary cap, the whole show. It just doesn't work for me. So this week's a game called Money Grabber. It's debuting here. You pick four players, and we're going to squish together the money that they make combined. You'll pick an A, a B, a C, and a D, all from world rankings. That's your team. And we'll do a projected money, how much money they're going to win all the way through the event. And the team that wins the most wins all the money.
That sounds pretty fun. That sounds fun. All right, so for those who are not already involved, Elk, how do they get involved?
We get the SG Tour app on the App Store. Go to the public game forum. Join the Elk and Hawk $10 game. We have a tour payout. So the top 64, just like the tour, Jimmy, that we cut. And the top 64 gamers make all the money.
Hey, Elk, Patrick Reed, cheater or no? Cheater or nah?
Well, he's already been penalized, convicted for what he did. So, you know, Reed, mate, it's such a big mistake what he did there. And mate, it's like the Astros, right? I still pull for the Astros, and you know, I've been listening to your show for decades. I mean, the baseball's had the biggest history of cheating ever in all the decades, but golf hasn't. Now, was the explanation from the Astros? No, wasn't very good. When the apology? No. Reed's apology? No, wasn't one. So, mate, he's wearing it. So, yeah, but definitely cheated, 100%.
He is a jungle legend. He is a 10-time winner on tour. He is the winner of the 95 PGA Championship. Of course, he is a 2-time winner of the Players' Championship. The creator of Secret Golf and the brain behind the SG Tour Golf app. And now you know, Steve Elkington. Elk, have an amazing week. Great to have you back, and we'll do it again soon.
Thank you, Jimmy. All the best.
You got it, mate. Alohi Gilman is my guest. Alohi, nice to have you on. How are you?
How you doing, Jim? Thanks for having me here today.
Yeah, it's great to have you here today. Nice to have you. All right, so you've had a little bit of time since the Combine. When you look back on the Combine itself, given all the work you put in to get ready for it, what kind of thoughts and memories do you have from that?
Yeah, the Combine was an amazing experience, definitely a surreal experience. You know, it's something as a kid that you dream of. But obviously, the Combine has its stresses and its challenges as well. So, you know, overall, it was a great experience, you know, just being able to get that opportunity and, you know, to kind of live out my dreams a little. And so, you know, it was a great experience, and I learned a lot, and I'm just happy to get that process over as well.
I bet. Now, in the past, you've said that the story of your life has people thinking that you can't run or you can't hit or you can't play at the next level. Knowing that, what was your mindset going into the Combine, and what did you want to show everybody?
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, I've always been, like I said, I've always been an under-the-radar kid, undersized, not as much attention. You know, I had no stars coming out of high school. You know, so for me, it was just being able to go out there and show all these scouts and GMs and coaches that, you know, I can play on a high level, that I can do all the things that, you know, some other guys who are 4 or 5 stars coming out of high school can or could do. Just make a statement of showing who I am as a person, who I am as a player, and what I bring to the table.
And then so much of that is where you're from and how you were brought up, and we'll get to that in a minute. Alohi Gilman is my guest. One more thing about the Combine is it came to a close. NFL Network reporter Kim Jones did a report on the fact that you cleaned up the entire corner of the end zone, you collected all the plastic bottles, used up tape and trash, and you made sure you put it in the trash cans. Seems to me most guys in your spots would have let the cleaning crew do that. Why was that important for you to do it yourself?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, I think my mom would be pretty disappointed in me if I didn't.
Right.
But other than that, you know, I think, you know, it's a part of how I was raised. You know, like we were about to talk about, it's just a sign of respect. That's how I was raised to do things, you know, picking up after yourself, leaving the place better than how you found it. And I just thought, you know, it was important for me to do that. It's kind of just a natural thing for me at this point. So that's a big attestment to the way my parents raised me, as well as where I was raised.
You know they were proud. Now, in terms of where you were raised, yes, you're from a small town on Oahu, and you've said that played a huge role in how you became the playmaker that you are on defense. So what is it about your hometown that grows competitors like that? Because that's not unusual.
Yeah, man. So I'm raised from a small town on the north shore of Oahu called La'ie. And, you know, the way I was raised, all those kids are raised are as much like myself in that we're all raised very competitive. You know, the way that we were raised, a tight-knit community, everything that we did was competitive. We just love to compete, love to do the things that anything you can find, flip quarters, you know, street hockey, anything you could do. And that's just kind of how I was raised and kind of instilled that competitive nature in my DNA. And so it's kind of a part of me at this point.
Alohi Gilman joining us, former Notre Dame safety. Now, your father played football at Southern Utah. Yes, you refer to him as your personal coach. What was it like growing up with him and learning from him?
Yeah, so, you know, my dad is a big testament to me as a player. He kind of groomed me into the player I am today. So he played as well. He also was a DB coach. He runs an academy down there called DB Tech Academy. So I played corner out of high school, and he's kind of, you know, groomed me into the player I am today, especially as a defensive back. He was a tough coach growing up. You know, he never let me slack off. He always pushed me to do more, to do extra. So, you know, he kind of instilled that work ethic, that sacrifice, and that motivation for me to take the next steps in playing at the highest level. And so a big testament to him. And, you know, for all the people in Hawaii who want to get some work, DB Tech Academy, Coach Gilman, and he'll get you right.
I like it. Alohi, I got to ask you now, we talked about you being the fact that you were no stars coming out, but your journey to this point is even more fascinating to me in the sense that we're talking about you in the NFL draft. The story goes that when you were in eighth grade, for instance, your coach told you would never play D1 football because of your size. What do you remember about that?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, story of my life, every level that I played in, specifically at that time, you know, I was eighth grade, I was, you know, kind of started to grow the passion of wanting to play football on a high level, and I set goals out for myself at that time. Maybe, you know, people never have seen the vision that I did, and, you know, my coach told me you would never play Division I football, at most maybe D1 AA or D2, so, you know, but at that point it kind of struck a fire on me, and there's still the chip on my shoulder that was built from back then, so my chip is only bigger now. And, you know, so seeing all these things of, you know, weaknesses or things that he can or can't do, you know, I'm really used to it at this point, and it just adds more fuel to the fire. But, you know, it's also just a fun journey to be a part of, because I get another opportunity to show everyone who I am, what I'm about, and, you know, in this next level, playing in the NFL will be the next step.
Hey, listen, you were right. I mean, you were right when the coaches may have been wrong, but I'm curious about that vision and how you had that at an early age. Mm-hmm. I mean, you heard that, and as an eighth grader, maybe you could have decided to focus on something else. You were playing basketball.
Yeah.
You were competing in track. Why did you not give up? Why did you not switch? Why did you stay the course?
Yeah, so, you know, for me, I was a very visionary person, and the way that I kept that vision really was just, you know, something that I pride myself in, something that I've built into the core of myself is just having an insane belief in myself. You know, I was a kid who dreamed the biggest dreams. You know, I was very visionary, imaginary, and deep down in my soul, in my core, in my heart, I felt like I could do anything that I set my mind to. And at times when people would tell me, you know, you can't do it, or at times where, you know, people would try to shut those dreams down, I never let that vision slip. So, you know, even from high school, going to the Naval Academy, to Notre Dame, you know, that vision stays alive. And I just have this insane belief in myself that I can do anything I put my mind to and my heart towards. And that passion just grows inside stronger every day.
Alohi Gilman joining me for a few more moments. It is strong. Now, in terms of Notre Dame, you initially went to the Naval Academy, but when the Department of Defense changed the rule that would have allowed you to complete your service after a professional sports career, you transferred to Notre Dame. What was it about Notre Dame that made you feel like that was the right fit?
Yeah. So, interestingly enough, you know, Navy and Notre Dame play every year.
Right.
I played Notre Dame my freshman year. I actually did really good. I had 13 tackles that game. And, you know, coming out of Navy and Naval Academy, I had two options, was Notre Dame and USC. USC obviously being closer to home, you know, a lot warmer weather and whatnot. USC was coming off a Rose Bowl win, and Notre Dame was coming off a 4-8 season. And interesting enough, you know, as I went on my official visits, I kind of decided, you know, Notre Dame was the best fit for me. Just overall, I felt like they were going in the right direction. The coaches were very honest with me. And I just saw myself being very successful there. And, you know, I was grateful and blessed to get that opportunity. And, you know, things worked out, and I'm very grateful for that.
You know, one of the rare honors you had also, you were a captain at Notre Dame, and you certainly earned that. How much of your approach to being a leader is about being a servant leader?
Yeah, I mean, that's everything. You know, if you're not a servant leader, people have a hard time, you know, being able to follow a guy who can't persuade and influence you. And I feel like for me, I'm always a guy who wants to help and serve. That's a part of being a leader. That's a part of being a part of something bigger than yourself is, you know, impacting the people around you. And I feel like that's something that I've grown in my perspective of leadership. And, you know, I'm just grateful that I got those opportunities, specifically at Notre Dame, to impact the culture, change the culture there at Notre Dame. And it's just been an amazing experience that I've gotten. And, you know, I definitely thank God for that.
You know, it's all upon you right now. The NFL draft's coming up. One last thought. You tweeted about a guy who's one of my favorites, Eric Weddle. When he retired,
yes,
you tweeted, quote, one of my favorite players ever. Thank you for showing the way, end quote. This, again, is a big Eric Weddle house. What did you like about watching him in his game? What did you learn from him?
Yeah, I mean, you know, first of all, on the field, he was so cerebral and balanced in the way that he could attack the field. And I felt like just his range and his passion and instincts overall was just something that, you know, you don't see every day on an NFL field, and even at the highest level. And so for me, growing up as a kid, I always used to watch his games when he was at San Diego, and, you know, just seeing him, and I try to modern my game after him and seeing the different things that he done. So watching a lot of film and tape on him and what he does and how he attacks the field. And so I was just, you know, putting my hats out towards him and, you know, just being able to watch him and learn from the things that he's done on the field.
He played safety at Notre Dame. He was named to the Nagurski and Thorpe watch list. 74 tackles, 3 tackles for a loss, etc. He set that Notre Dame record for most tackles in a game with 19 against Clemson. And you've got the 2020 NFL draft getting underway April 23rd in Vegas. Alohi, I've certainly talked about you on the show, but you and I have never spoken before today. I'm glad we finally got to it. Good luck at the draft. Okay. And I'll look for you after you find out where you're going to live and work.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
According to Insurance Information Institute of America, over 300 million cases of identity theft are filed every single year. According to Jim Rome of America, you can make that 3,000,001 because Tim Lincecum just got his jacked on Twitter. You remember Timmy? He was a force in nature, this guy. 2-time Cy Younger, 3-time world champion, 4-time All-Star for the San Francisco Giants. I mean, my man was the freak.
Hey, this is the freak.
Dude was the franchise.
Hey, this is the franchise.
Dude was the freaky franchise.
Hey, this is the freaky franchise here.
You know what this dude was? Big time Timmy Jim.
Big time Timmy Jim's office here.
Tim Lincecum.
This is Tim Lincecum.
That dude. You remember that dude? Well, some 25-year-old knob from Stroudsburg, PA, has been masquerading around on Twitter as the 35-year-old pitcher from Bellevue, Washington. And he's been hooking people also. Most recently, this con man pretended to be Lincecum, and he got Baltimore Ravens tight end Hayden Hurst to mail him a bunch of game-worn signed jerseys under the guise that they'd be auctioned off for charity. And if by auctioned off for charity, he meant auctioned off on eBay for himself, then yes, they were auctioned off for charity. What's truly amazing about this, and actually pretty fascinating, is that the crook decided to go with Tim Lincecum as his decoy. I mean, kind of genius, right? Mostly idiotic. But in small parts, genius. Genius in the sense that Lincecum is extremely offline. In fact, some would call him a recluse, and have. So using him as an avatar for an online scam might be considered smart in the sense that big-time Timmy Jim himself would never see it or hear about it because he's never online. But it's idiotic because somebody close to him probably would. I mean, the guy is baseball's version of Anthony Kim, right? An outright freak with all the swag who just disappeared right off the face of the earth, but will randomly pop up for a second here or there. Or somebody will report a sighting of him here or there. Last time anybody saw Tim Lincecum was when he came back to the yard in a surprise appearance for Bruce Bochy's final game this past September. And I'm not sure the fans were expecting it because when he was announced, the crowd lost its bleep and gave him a 5-minute standing O. 5-minute standing O. Boch himself had this to say after the game.
Timmy's, you know, he's a tough one to get a hold of. I've tried to text him. I tried to see him in Seattle. And then, of course, when he was announced, that put me over the edge a little bit. And I said, there's no way I'm going to get through this. I've said Timmy is somebody that's really close to my heart. And for him to come down here, pretty big deal for me, because I know he's not a guy that looks to be around.
This is why this guy running around impersonating him is such a moron. Bruce Bochy can't find Tim Lincecum. His manager can't find him anywhere. Can't ring him, can't text him, or at least not get a return text. But Timmy himself is just going to show up on Twitter and start tweeting other athletes asking for things. Oh, okay. I mean, there have been so many articles written about how reclusive this guy is and about how hard it is to find this guy and how people don't have success when looking for him. A reporter from the Bay Area News Group went to his Seattle area home back in 2017, rang the doorbell for a week straight, never got an answer. Obviously, Hayden Hurst didn't know all this. Hayden Hurst was trying to do the right thing. Hayden Hurst was trying to reciprocate and do what athletes do, help each other out for charity. He had no clue that the guy asking for signed gamers is a guy that nobody's been able to find for years outside of that cameo at Boch's final game. However, as I said, Timmy may not know, and maybe somebody really close to him doesn't pick up on it, but Hurst's agent did. Hurst's agent found the signed jerseys, and lo and behold, they were not up for auction for a charity, but they were up for auction on eBay. It's not a very hard trail to find, right? Let's see. Somebody asked my guy for jerseys. It sounds pretty sketchy. Where do we look first? I don't know. eBay? Oh, what do you know? They're all right there. He finds them there a short while later. They tell the cops. They track this perp down 10 months later for some reason and finally got around to arresting him. According to the cops, this scam artist had been using multiple accounts to dupe other athletes into sending him cleats, gloves, balls, hats, picks, and WWE championship belts. All of this while the real Tim Lincecum, I think, his actual Twitter feed, and I say I think because it's non-blue check verified, hasn't had anything live or anything tweeted since 2012. This dude probably thought, man, I got this. This is going to go on forever. Because Lincecum is never going to check to Twitter. Yeah, maybe not, but again, somebody close to him might. Or the guy you're trying to scam may have an idea about sports and know that this guy doesn't come around. And before you know it, the cops did. They came knocking, hit him with charges of identity theft, theft by deception, and unlawful use of a computer. And while I personally know nothing at all about life on the inside, I don't think other inmates look too kindly on unlawful use of a computer. Man, what a month it's been for former Giants pitchers and their double identities. First, you have Madison Bumgarner's out here at the rodeo roping cattle and winning tens of thousands of bucks as Mason Saunders. And now you've got big-time Timmy Jim, a victim of identity theft. What are you going to tell me next? That my guy Brian Wilson was rocking a fake beard? That it was actually glued on? That it was never real? Calling Lincecum a victim might not be the right word here. It's not like he lost anything. There's a real good chance that he's got no clue that I'm even talking about him or that he's even in the news. We may never find the real Timmy L ever again. But you can find the fake one, perhaps, one day soon behind bars in Pennsylvania. Man, what a whack story. Or to quote Brian Wilson, that is some proverbial poo, if I ever heard it.
And we can just shoot the proverbial poo.
I miss my guy, Brian Wilson. We had some classic interviews back in the day. Let's get weird. He was an all-time jungle legend. J-R-I-B legend, jungle legend. Who's next? Where's it all end? Will Clark? Robbie Thompson, Jeff Kent, Rick Rushel, my man JT Snow. JT came to a tour stop way back in the day. In fact, JT Snow was at one of the multi-tour stops when we did three in one day. I think he hit one of those. He kind of stayed to himself a little bit. JT. REX in the ABQ. Hello, Rex. Hello, Rex.
Hey, Romy. You know what? I've got a beef. Like anybody else, I'm concerned about the corona, but it's not going to keep me away from the Panda Express. So I was there for lunch the other day, and guess who's in front of me? Guy who asks for chopsticks at Panda Express. Hey, guy, who do you think you are? More importantly, where do you think you are? This isn't Geisha House. I know you think you're being cultured by using chopsticks on your double orange chicken, but you're not. You're just being an ass. And speaking of ass, better stop worrying about those chopsticks and get the bathroom code from that cashier instead, because everyone knows you're not getting out of the express without smoking out that gopher.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Thanks, Rex. Thank you very much, Rex. We go to Dallas. Matt in Dallas. Matt, what is your beef?
I got beef with poor service at a packed restaurant. Like, I didn't choose your job. Don't give me poor service because your place is packed. Honestly, you should be glad it's packed. You're probably going to get a nice tip. That's my beef.
Got you, Matt. You know what's even worse than bad service? We're wrapping up our What's Your Beef segment. We do it every single Tuesday. Let's go to Clearwater. Mike in Clearwater. Mike, what's your beef?
What's up, Jim? I got a beef with people at service dogs with no apparent ailment whatsoever. They trot their little flea-ridden dogs into the restaurant, to the supermarket. They're totally fine. They can see fine. They can hear fine. They're walking fine. What do they need to bring that dog into the restaurant for? You know, they've got that stupid little vest, and they don't want you to look at it or touch it. Don't touch my service dog. It's a service dog. Don't approach my dog. Come on, get yourself together and leave your stupid mangy mutt at home. I'm out.
Angry much? Hey, Mike, what if they really do have a reason for having a service dog? What if they need a service dog? Mike, my man, I think you may need an emotional support dog to deal with your anger issues.
Good night!